Welcome to Portland Speaks, a podcast featuring interesting conversations with interesting Mainers, hosted by Tanner Campbell and recorded weekly at the Portland Pod in South Portland, Maine. Thanks for tuning in. Let's begin. Today I'm chatting with a real mensch, a guy who got started in beer, moved to semiconductors, and wound up opening a deli. Wound up opening two, actually, which wasn't really what he wanted to hear him tell it, but which has certainly brought him a lot of fulfillment as a business owner and local Portlander. I'm speaking, of course, of
Pete Levitt. I currently own a couple delis in Falmouth and Portland.
Did you notice his use of the word currently there? I did, and my immediate reaction was, I wonder what he's going to own next. But before we climb into Pete's bottomless well of ambition, and no, that's not a euphemism, I think we should first explore what brought him to Maine when he was in his early 20s. It wasn't our pine trees, wasn't our rocky shoals or perfect summers, it wasn't our stellar personalities or zest for life, it wasn't any of that regular stuff. But if it wasn't for that regular stuff, then what was it that brought him to Maine?
Beer. But this was a long time ago, beer.
Not a bad reason. At least I don't think so. And we're going to learn the specifics in just a minute. But since he's not from Maine, let's find out where he is from first.
Bainbridge, Maryland. My dad was a Navy guy. And we moved out of there when I was about 5 months old to Longmeadow, Massachusetts, which is near Springfield out in sort of Western Mass. And that's where I grew up. That's where I lived my whole life.
Well, not his whole life, right? This isn't the Bainbridge Speaks podcast. Pete got to Maine soon enough, but let's figure out how exactly.
So I graduated from college with a degree in economics, and everybody was going to work on Wall Street. And I said, I am not going to work on Wall Street. I've always been a food guy since I was 15. I've worked in food. And I said, I'm going to go to California. Because that's as far as Wall Street as you can pretty much get. So I was working out there in food. I was working at a catering company. I worked at a place called the Haight Street Deli right on Haight Street. So I worked food for a while, and then I got my brother-in-law was working at one of the first brew pubs in the country, a place called Triple Rock in Berkeley. That he opened in 1984. I think they were the second or third brew pub in the country. But it was Buffalo Bill's Brew House, I think was one of the first ones in Emeryville or in Oakland, California. And then there was a couple around there. Geary's actually opened up sort of around the same time on this side of the country. I think he might not have been that early. But so I talked to my brother-in-law. He said, hey, you know, they're looking for someone to help in the brewery if you want to do that. I said, yeah, I could do that. He said, it comes with free beer. I said, yeah, I definitely do that. So I started brewing beer, which I really liked. And as much as I liked cooking, brewing beer was sort of one of the first things I said, I could see myself doing this in 10 years. Like, this is really fun. It took what I liked about cooking food, which is with cooking food, you get sort of an immediate feedback, right? When you work in a restaurant, you send a plate of food out. If it comes back empty, you know they liked it. But you constantly have to make one plate of food at a time. We're making beer, it's like you make a big batch of beer and then constantly people are drinking it. So you get the constant feedback, but you don't have to put the constant effort into making each glass of beer. So it really played well into my sense of laziness as well as constant insecurity of wanting to have people tell me that they actually liked what I was doing.
Right. And desire to not work on Wall Street.
And desire to not have to go work on Wall Street.
Well, all right. It looks like things are shaping up pretty well for Pete. What happens next?
I worked at a place in Berkeley, and then one of those owners opened a brew pub called 20 Tank right in San Francisco, down in South Market area. And I did that. I loved opening the place up. I mean, just starting from installing the system to coming up with the recipes. And I was still an assistant brewer. I had some great people I was working with at the time. And I heard one of the guys that I was working for went to Chicago, went to a place called Siebel Institute of Brewing Technology, which is one of the top three or four brewing schools in the world. at that time. There's Weinsteffen in Germany, which you have to speak German, which I nicht,
and that's all
nicht
the,
Deutsch.
That's all the purity law stuff over there too. So it's there are more rules to being on that.
Well, the Reinheitsgebot is the German. I think that's how it pronounced, something like that. Is the German purity law, but Weinsteffen, they're not teaching that strict. They're sort of teaching the whole science of it. UC Davis has always had a great course, and then Siebel Institute was sort of right up there as well. So in my family, sort of lifelong education, continual learning is sort of embedded in our genes. I said, you know, all right, let's go back to school and see what this is all about. And so that was sort of the executive graduate course, 400 hours, 40 weeks, 40 hours a week, 10 weeks in Chicago, which was great. You know, your homework was have some beers and think about, you know, how this other stuff works. I was like, oh, okay.
Which is what you were going
to
do anyway.
Which is what I was going to do, right? We'd get together with a couple guys, and Chicago is a great place for that. But most of the brewers there were big brewers. They were from, a lot of them from Coors, Miller. Mm. You get some of the smaller regional ones in the U.S., as well as breweries in China and Brazil. This is where international breweries would send their people because it was in English. They could understand it. It wasn't a four-year course like UC Davis. So there was about three or four of us that were under the age of 40 that knew what we were doing. And so we were sort of the new breed back then. And the instructors constantly would test us, thinking, these guys don't know anything about brewing. And it turns out we actually knew more than the corporate guys, because the corporate guys sort of sat behind a panel and, sure, and you know, moved levers, where we were there with the canoe paddle actually stirring the grain in.
That, and I imagine that they weren't just, they were probably also locked into a mentality of what beer was supposed to be like, and there were more restriction to what
they were, but their creativity. But they were also trained of, you know, when it hits this temperature, do this, and it will always hit that temperature because it's all very controlled. We're in a small system. You say, well, you need to get to this temperature because these reactions need to happen. And if it doesn't get to that temperature, if it goes over that temperature, then here's what's going to happen, and here's what you need to do. You really need to have a more intimate knowledge, right, when you're working on that small scale
of
what's going on. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I graduated from Siebel, and I put my shingle out as a brewery consultant. I helped open up a place in Telluride, Colorado, which I don't think is there anymore. I was up in Oregon and just sort of bouncing around, and a guy called. He said, hey, you know, I heard about you. I need you to come to Maine. I'm opening a brewery. So I moved up to Bethel, Maine, after the last sort of permanent address I had was in San Francisco. And I loved San Francisco, but it was just so crowded. This was even in the late 80s, it was crowded. And since that time, I had been pretty much living out of a duffel bag. You know, I unpacked a little bit in Chicago, but I was still sort of, you know, living in someone else's apartment. And then just sort of traveling the country, living out of a backpack. And I got to Bethel, and it finally struck me that I really actually liked that area. I liked not having traffic. I liked not having traffic lights. Mm. I liked not having a lot of people around. I loved, you know, being outside and being in the woods and being in the hills. And this was even before ski season hit. And so we opened up the Sunday River Brewing Company in 90, I think that was still 91, December of 91. And the original intention was I was going to get that open and then move on to the next job. And within about 4 or 5 months of getting the place opened up, I talked to my partner at the time, and I said, you know, well, what are you looking to do? He was a young guy. He had some family finances. And he said, you know, I just want to open a bunch of these. I said, well, great. That's what I want to do, you know. So I became partners with him. And then in 94, we opened up a place called Stone Coast here in Portland. That was a fun place. That was big. It was like 12,000 square feet.
Which is an enormous bar. And many of you likely remember it. Unfortunately, big as it was and fun as it was, it did not last.
So that was 94. We went and opened up another brewery in Laconia, New Hampshire about a year later in 95. 96, 97 or so, we started contract brewing out of what was then Casco Bay Brewing Company. And so they were brewing some of our beers for us that we would sell. So they were brewing our Black Bear Porter and our 420 IPA. They may have been doing, did we do the Redstone at that point? We had probably three or four that they were brewing. So at that point, I was in charge of three breweries as well as sales of distribution beer. And it really wasn't what I wanted to do. The expression, you get kicked upstairs. I mean, that was it. I liked brewing beer. I wasn't brewing beer anymore. So things started sort of coming apart. My partner and I at that point sort of looked at each other and said, I think we're about done here. And so I left in 99 and moved on. And then Stone Coast closed, I think, in 2000 or 2001. And so that whole organization sort of unraveled a couple years after that.
Now, if this were me, I'd be feeling pretty low, feeling like everything I'd worked towards was gone and scared to start over again. But here's where we get a look at Pete's ability to regularly and somewhat seemingly easily reinvent himself when the chips are down and the world is changing around him.
Maybe it's time to go back to school again, right? That's sort of that always, as I say, ingrained of lifelong learning, continual education.
Sure.
So I went to an open house at USM for the graduate program, the MBA program. And I'm sitting there the whole time, I'm thinking, I'm too old to start doing this. This is stupid. And I'm sitting next to this woman who's not young, and most of the student body in at USM, especially in the graduate program, are non-traditional students. And I was chatting with her and I said, what do you think? She goes, I think I got to do this. I said, yeah. I said, I'm just thinking, I'm too old to start doing this. She said, I'm 47. She said, in 3 years, I'm going to be 50. She said, in 3 years, I can either be 50 and have a graduate degree, or I can be 50 without a graduate degree. I think I'll be better off with a graduate degree, so I might as well. I wasn't even close to 50. I said, well, hell, that sounds like pretty solid.
Well, now I gotta
do it. That sounds like pretty solid reasoning. So I went to, I was going to graduate school, and I said, I know what small business is all about. I've always been my own boss. I know what that's about. I have no idea what corporate America is all about. So I got an internship at Fairchild Semiconductor.
Yeah, you heard that right. Semiconductors. Semiconductors are not beer, and they are not deli meat. But change is, at the very least, different. And different can be good. Sometimes. Right? Let's see.
Fairchild is part of what they call the World Semiconductor Trade Organization, which is WSTS. And every 6 months, WSTS has a big meeting around somewhere in the world, and whatever region hosts the meeting. And they get together, and this is how they come up with the forecast for what semiconductor demand is going to be in the next 6 months and a year. And they sent me as the envoy from Fairchild with fairly very little idea of what we were doing there. And you go into these sessions, and so analog was a big part of Fairchild. So you go into these sessions, and it's like, okay, all the analog makers. And you would go into a room, and they would say, how many people are looking at, 5% growth? And you'd just like raise your hand. And then people would just sort of, it was the craziest thing. And they'd say, okay, well, so we figured that, worldwide demand is going to increase by 3.2% next year. Really? Like, this is how you guys come up with these numbers? And then you see the press releases. It's like, well, the World Trade Organization, well, Semiconductor Trade Organization has, determined that the semiconductor growth is going to go up by 6.9% next year. Oh, 6.9. It's like, that seemed like there should have been more to it. But that was it.
Okay. Definitely different, if not maybe a little unsettling. Certainly something Pete thought was an odd experience. But it wasn't just the meetings that Pete found odd. It was the whole of corporate structure.
The politics of corporate is something that I still don't really get. The concept that, that the later you're in the office, the better the worker you are. Mm. Some people, a sign of having nothing on your desk was a sign that you had a lot of power because you had other people doing all the work. Other people having a lot of stuff on your desk was the sign of power because it showed that you were doing all the work. I didn't really understand how you decided who was in which camp. There was one guy I remember, he was pretty high up there. He would sort of disappear all day and he'd come back around 4 and he'd say, where you been? Oh, I was home. I had to, paint the bottom of my boat. He's like, okay, so are you guys ready to get to work? We're going to be here till about 10 o'clock tonight. And these guys have been working all day. And they're like, yeah, sure, no problem. Here we go. I'm thinking, this is stupid.
Just want to take a quick minute to thank you all for listening and to ensure that you've taken the opportunity to formally subscribe to the show. If you're listening to us on a podcast listening app, you've probably already got it sorted. But if you're listening to this episode from our website or on one of our social media profiles, there's a better way to listen. If you're on an iPhone or an iPad, subscribe through Apple Podcasts. If you're on an Android device, download and install the Radio Public app. It's free. If you're dead set on listening to us on your laptop or computer, though, consider looking us up on Spotify or iHeartRadio and adding us to your podcasting playlist. Anyway, thanks for listening and for subscribing. Let's get back to Pete and see how things worked out. Pete's wife noticed way before he did, but when he finally did, it was like he knew it all along. Pete needed to work for himself. He wasn't a paper pusher, he wasn't a grunt, and he didn't have the tolerance for leadership he disagreed with. And maybe that's a feature of entrepreneurs or small business owners. They just have to do things their way. That's good though, right? Someone has to open the businesses and take the risks, so why not a Levitt? Why not Pete? But what would he do?
I don't want a lunch rush. I really just want to sell like cured cheeses and aged meats, like, you know, like a prosciutto shop. That would have been the ideal. If I just could have sold like two or three kinds of prosciutto and just sliced that all day, I would have been really happy.
And you wind up with a friggin' deli.
Right.
So Where did you go wrong?
My initial tagline was smoked, aged, cured. Like that's all I was going to sell, was stuff that was smoked, aged, and cured. And that was it. And I had to sign up. So I got the property on the corner of Route 1 and Depot Road in Falmouth, which was a great corner, great property, but great
super
location.
Super overgrown, if I remember our previous conversation.
At that point, yeah, that property wasn't overgrown. Right, the lot next to me where the Rite Aid is was just, yeah, overgrown weeds in a burned out house that had been there for 20 years. But they kept saying, "Oh, well, no, somebody's coming in. They're going to build something here." So I don't care. I'm right on the corner. Everybody can see me. I don't care what's behind me. So I had a sign up on the roof saying Levitt and Sons, and then in small letters it said "Smoked, Aged, Cured," and specialty food store. But nobody could read that as they're driving by. All they see is Levitt and Sons.
Now, of course, we know Pete, and we know now that he owns a deli. But yeah, I guess Levitt and Sons does have kind of funeral homey ring to it.
It got off to a slow start, and people would come in and they'd say, "Oh, you know, I saw the sign. I thought, you know, maybe you were like a funeral home or lawyers." Or,
so I stopped because you might be.
Well, but you know, they say, "Well, I kept driving by, and then you know, I figured I'd see what was going on in here." But you know, or I'd get a lot of calls, people that wanted to rent tents. I'd say, "No, that's Levitt in Paris." They'd say, "Oh, you know, we bought some stuff at your store, and you know, the t-shirt doesn't fit." I'd say, "No, that's Levitt and Chase. Those guys, this is different." But eventually it caught on. And so after about 8 years of running up there, I said, "All right, I guess it's time to do something stupid again and open a second one."
So it was time to go shopping for a new building.
So then when I started looking for a property, I started looking up on Washington Street because that's where all the cool places were going to be. And the spaces I saw up there were sort of too small. They were sort of a little too chopped up for what I was doing. And then my broker said, "Oh, you know, well, there's this other development that's going on down in West Bayside." And I'd sort of already started looking in the East Bayside area, as they call it, where all the breweries are. Cause I was aware that was sort of up and coming, and that was sort of a cool area. And there was really nothing, for rent. And even places on Washington Avenue that have, new stores in them now, that stuff was not available 4 years ago. So like where Forage and the Shop are, that place, you know, I was told that guy's never going to move out of there. You know, he's, and if he does, it's going to be way too expensive for anything but like an office. And that didn't turn out to be true, but, I was done sort of looking up there. And so my broker pitched going into the little plaza where Chipotle is. Yep. And I said, maybe it's not really what I was thinking. And then I looked at the numbers. They said, "Well, this is what we want for rent." I said, "Well, I'd like to pay like a half of that." And so my broker said, "Oh, well, you know, I'll ask him." And so then I got this thing back, you know, and it says, we've got space for you at this price. I'm like, huh, 200 Kennebec Street. I'm like, wait, that's not in the plaza. That's across the street. And across the street was sort of this leaning over wooden warehouse building.
Perfect. I'll tell you.
But the rent was good.
Pete and I spoke for over 2 hours. And the amount of wrangling and chopping I had to do to the audio of that conversation to get things down to a manageable length was daunting, to say the least. Pete has a lot of great stories, and he's a real blast to hang out with. During those 2 hours, he told me a ton of those stories. We listened to The Cliffs of Dover by Eric Johnson. We drank whiskey. We shared a couple of beers. And we chewed the fat about all manner of completely random and not interrelated topics. But there is no way I could include all of that in this single episode. So, patrons, expect a lot of great stuff in the uncut version, which we'll post later this weekend. If you're not a patron, hang in there until the end of this episode, and I'll give you some details on how you can become one. I decided to ask Pete about the increasing diversity in Portland, because I, in fact, had already asked him about it the first time we met while I was vetting him as a guest for the show. I knew what he was going to say, and I wanted to include it as the last question of this episode because Pete defined diversity differently than previous guests had, and I felt that was worth including here.
Racially diverse is different than culturally diverse.
Yes.
And where I think you told me that other people had thought it was becoming more diverse for the good or the bad of the city, mm-hmm. and I said I think it's becoming less diverse because the diversity is getting priced out of Portland. So when I moved down to Portland, and even before, when I was living in Bethel, and I would deliver kegs of beer down to the accounts that we had down in Portland, it was classic New England. It's still, I guess, fishing town, where you know there were a lot of somewhat abandoned buildings, which isn't necessarily great for a city, but it made for easy parking, which I really appreciated. Bars that were there, everybody sort of went to the same bars. The bars were the bar. And you would have the lawyers and the fishermen all sitting together. And if you wanted to go get a drink, you got a drink and everybody got along. What I see happening now, and it didn't just start. It probably started with Cafe Una. It was a Una Cafe maybe, which opened up sort of across the street from Stone Coast, where Zapoteca used to be. Mm. And it was like the first martini bar in Portland. And Portland had, you know, it's like a martini bar. And people are like, that's crazy, you know?
That's not what you think of.
That's not what you think of for Portland. And it was very sort of European feel and, you know, sort of cool and glass. And they made these, you know, 10-ounce martinis. They were charging $10 for it. It was ridiculous. You know, who's gonna pay $10 for a martini? I was like, well, I will. and they were great drinks. They were all just, you know, great drinks. But suddenly this was a bar that not everybody could go to. Mm. And since then it's really you know, there's been such a huge influx of people moving into Portland, coming up from New York and coming up from Boston, you know, to open restaurants, among other things. And, you know, 90% of the time you see these write-ups of, you know, the Portland's great new restaurant is this chef came up from New York because he wanted to find basically cheap rent. Mm. And that's sort of what started. And now people want to come up because it's got this vital food scene, but it's a lot of people from more expensive places coming up that look at the rent up here and they say, oh, you know, $1,200 for a studio, that's cheap. That's not cheap for people that live up here, you know. Mm-hmm. So the diversity is getting priced out of Portland proper. The bars and restaurants are definitely segregating themselves into who can afford a $25 entree versus going and get some Red Hots at Tommaso's for, you know, $2 for $3 and you get your shot and a beer, which I still appreciate. So it's racially, sexual orientation, that kind of diversity is certainly increasing. I think from a financial demographic, I think it's becoming a lot more uniform. You know, it's not a new argument. It's the lack of affordable housing for the people that work at all the restaurants. I mean, I see it with the people that, you know, work for me. I mean, a lot of them live still in Portland, and they live in somewhere the older cheaper neighborhoods that like Parkside, you know, Grant Street, Sherman Street. Those were, you know, sort of dangerous neighborhoods back in the early 90s. Not so much anymore. And that's where a lot of these kids live. And, you know, there's still these places. But, you know, you drive around, I'll tell you, you drive around the east side of Portland, and I don't even know where I am anymore. It's just these, you know, monolithic, brick-clad, sort of uniform-looking buildings. And, you know, you could be in Boston, you could be in Tucson, you could, you know, you could be anywhere. It's really, it's, I think, very close to losing some of the character of the city because of just these massive buildings going up at this point.
So not a net good in your estimation?
I can't judge whether it's a net good or not. I mean, certainly there are benefits to it. But I like being over on the Bayside. I like being on the other side of the hill. It feels a little more real to me down there. It feels a little more like this is going to stay a local place more. I specifically did not want to open in the Old Port. I did not want my customer base to be transient tourists who, you know, I would see just new faces every day. I really like being part of the community that I'm in, having the local customers, knowing what people are doing, knowing what people want. Even today we had a woman that comes in, she has the same order of deli meat every week. And I got a call from my manager in Falmouth. She said, you know, she just called up here for her deli order. I think she just called the wrong number. I said, I think so. She said, should we slice it? I said, hold off. If she comes in up there, we'll explain the situation. Sure enough, she comes into the Portland location a half hour later. I said, hi. She said, yeah, I called. I said, you called Falmouth. She said, oh, I said, we can get the order done in like 5 minutes. I said, we just didn't want to slice it because I thought maybe you were going to be in Falmouth today. Yeah. So you wanted to pick it up, even though she always picks it up in Portland. But it's that kind of interaction with the customer of not only knowing who they are, but understanding, you know, what they need, what they want, and even being able to cover when they get the wrong phone number in the phone.
Patrons, please expect the full and uncut version by Sunday. And to those of you who are not yet patrons, here's how to become one and why you should. First, head on over to patreon.com/PortlandSpeaks. There's a link in the description. When you get there, pledge $5 of monthly support to the show. As soon as you do that, you'll have access to all the uncut versions of all of our interviews. And, this is the best part, in your second month of support, you'll get a Portland Speaks sticker for your car. And in your third month, you'll get a Portland Speaks t-shirt. Like, a good one. Not a cheap undershirt with an iron-on decal that comes off after a couple times in the wash. Patrons help us to earn a living off this production and prevent us from having to place ads in the show or become beholden to sponsors or sponsor influence. And nobody likes ads. So do your part and become a patron today at patreon.com/PortlandSpeaks. Portland Speaks is produced weekly by the Portland Pod, Maine's first commercial podcasting studio, located at 1486 Broadway in South Portland. Thanks for listening, subscribing, and supporting. I'm grateful to have you as a listener, and I will see you next week. Take care.